Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. And then there were five. Well, actually, now there are five because this morning, John Barros, who until last week was Boston's chief of economic development, officially announced that he is running for mayor. Barros ran for mayor in 2013, placing sixth among a crowded field in the preliminary election. Marty Walsh, who went on to win that race, made him chief of the city's first cabinet-level economic development office. John Barros joins us now. John, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
Great to have you. So, John, this is your second run. You ran in 2013 on a record of management as former head of the Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative. You've served now as the city's chief of economic development for almost the entire Walsh term. So tell us, why are you the right next person to lead the city of Boston?
Well, I think I'm the right next person to lead Boston because of my rare executive and management set of experiences and skills. As you know, I started very early on as a young man organizing my community and trying to give back to a community that gave me so much. I started, and then not long after, was the executive director of the Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative, where I'd led for about 13 years. And you know, at the Dudley Street, we were able to not just vision and plan, we were able to implement those visions and plans and build housing and build community centers, schools, playgrounds, urban agriculture, a 10,000 square foot greenhouse that we're really proud of. I took those same skills to government. I took the same value of community participation, resident-led planning, to go in and find a mayor who wanted to reform government. And in fact, that's why we started the Economic Development Cabinet. Before that, economic development was more of a regulatory activity. You put in your application, there'd be a conversation about zoning, there'd be a conversation about use. But the creation of the Economic Development Cabinet allowed us to be clear about the values, about the policies we wanted to push, and how we could prioritize equity and inclusion as we grew our economy.
So let me stop you there, John. You just talked about the policies you wanted to push. What would voters expect from a John Barros agenda?
You know, John Barros' agenda would prioritize equity, would prioritize participation and involvement, would prioritize climate change. We would make sure that Boston was a city that was welcoming to everyone, that our economy allowed for participation. We would also make sure that it was accessible in a way where people can buy housing, they can pay for rent. Affordable housing has been a passion of mine as we were able to build housing at DS&I. I also found an administration that really sort of cared about housing. And so we have built record level of affordable housing in Boston. We will continue to do that under Barros' administration. And then lastly,
so John, you've talked. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Just one last thing is we would make sure to prioritize children and young people. My work has always been about young people and their development. And in a Barros administration, we would education would be a priority and child well-being.
So, John, you've talked about equity a couple of times. You just said you run on your record for management. So I want to give you a chance to address the federal complaint that was filed last month by minority business advocates over a report finding that only a little over 1% of the city's annual, and I want to get this right, the city's annual contracting dollars between 2014 and 2019, a little over 1% went to qualifying businesses owned by people of color and women. I know you know that Shagun Idowu, who's the executive director of the Black Economic Council of Massachusetts, they participated in the complaint, told the Bay State Banner that they'd been talking with you about this, you and Mayor Walsh, for a long time, and he, quote, said, they keep saying they're going to do something about this, yet here we are. I want to give you a chance to address that, John. Why was that percentage so low?
Yeah, you know, Shagun's right. We've been talking to him about it for a long time. We've been talking to him about it ever since we went into government. which is why Shagun has been part of our supplier diversity advisory council at the city. Both, in fact, Shagun and one other complainant on the civil complaint were part of a group of activists that work with us because we care about it. And let's be clear, there is no time in the city's 400 years where minority or women-owned businesses participated in a fair way in discretionary spending. There is none. But the Walsh administration, and I particularly, wanted to make the numbers transparent, and we wanted to do something about it. The only way you can handle an issue like that is you've got to look at the data, you've got to look at the information. So we spent some years learning from, from the fears of some of the other administrations, and then decided that a disparity study was a critical tool needed to shift that that trend. So after cleaning up the information, we launched a disparity study that looked at the spending for 5 years, which is what disparity studies do, in order to create the legal framework for goals. And I'm super excited that Mayor Walsh was able to sign an executive order that now has created a goal of 25% of Boston's discretionary spend would go to women and minority-owned companies. That's about $160 million a year. It's far beyond any other goal the city has had, and it's true commitment that comes from the roadmap that the disparity study laid out. We now know more, and the public knows more. And we didn't shy away from it, Tiziana. We went on it head first, which is why that disparity study was done.
So that raises another question that I think will come up during the race, which is to what extent will voters see your candidacy as a referendum on or an extension of the Walsh administration? And how do you see that? And if you don't want that to be the case, what do you need to do differently so that your candidacy and, if you're elected, your mayoralty would be different?
Well, I think, you know, voters, vote on the fact that I have a track record of being serious about equity and inclusion. I've done more than any other administration past. But we went in and changed the wording and the goals on the Boston Jobs, Boston's job residency jobs program for the city of Boston, demanding that at least 51% of the jobs on publicly benefited projects were local, 40% minority, and at least 12% women for construction jobs. Those are the highest goals we've ever seen in Boston. We raised those goals. Then we put some real teeth in the ordinance around how we would track it and how we would hold people accountable. That's the kind of work that they can expect from the Barrows administration. We still have work to do, both on the contracting and jobs, to make sure people can participate more. And so, because we've made those changes, I'm able to go in there and push for the kinds of things that government need to do to meet those goals. And so on the disparity study side, setting the goals is the first step, but making sure that companies can actually participate in our contracts is the next, right? So you'd have to do at least, three things. You have to make sure that the large contracts were split and made accessible to some of our women-owned and minority-owned companies. Because of the disparity study, we know who's out there. We know what their capabilities are. We know what their contracting history is. So when we look at something like, Boston's waste management contract, there's one company that picks up waste for the entire city. If you were able to divide that up, you might have some people that could actually apply for them or bid on it to participate. Those large contracts need to be split up. Secondarily, you would have to create some kind of a way for our smaller businesses to have cash flow. Either we're paying them quicker or we're fronting some cash up front so they can actually float some of the debt that they would need to work on city contracts. And then lastly, the city put forth, a clear effort to try to affirmatively market to certified businesses in the city of Boston. We need to put in the system in place to continue to do those kinds of things to make sure that companies can participate. So, a Barrows administration would continue to follow through on the work that we started.
So, John, in our last 30 seconds or so, this is an incredibly diverse candidate pool. What does it mean to the city to have this much diversity in the race for mayor? Just in a couple sentences.
Well, this is, it's clearly an honor to run in this diverse group of candidates. You know, good candidates. Boston's ready. Boston's ready to make a statement about its leadership. It's ready to have someone of color. It's ready to have a woman. It's ready to have a Black man like me in office. And I'm proud to be part of a city that is so accepting of the diversity of quality candidates that are in this race.
So that is former Boston Chief of Economic Development and now candidate for Mayor John Burroughs. John, thanks for joining us. I hope you'll come back again.
Thanks for having me. Be well.
Now, for the second time in a week, a construction worker in Greater Boston has died on the job. Yesterday, a worker was killed and a second was critically injured in Cambridge when a section of a concrete stairwell inside a parking garage collapsed during renovation. And last Wednesday, two workers were killed at a site in downtown Boston after a truck knocked them into a hole in the road. These two incidents are raising questions about how we keep construction workers safe on the job, especially as buildings keep going up in the city and going up fast. So we're going to explore that, and we invite your thoughts. As construction projects continue throughout Greater Boston, are we doing enough to keep workers safe? What do you think? Especially in a pandemic, how do we prioritize the health and the safety of our workers, all workers? And have you seen anything unsafe happening at construction sites around the city of Boston? You can call us with any of that. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Joining us now are Boston City Councilor Ed Flynn, who was leading the charge for a hearing to look into last week's tragedy in Boston, and Massachusetts Building and Trades Council President Frank Callahan. Councilor Flynn, Frank Callahan, welcome to Radio Boston.
It's good to be with you.
It's good to be with you, and Councilor Flynn, thank you, Tiziana.
It's great to have you both. So, Councilor Flynn, I'm going to start with you. You have called for hearings. What did you think when you first heard of the tragedy in downtown Boston last week?
Well, I first thought of the construction workers and their families. It's a terrible loss, so our prayers went immediately to the families. But also, it also went directly to what are we doing at construction sites to make them as safe as possible for our workers and for neighbors and pedestrians that live in and around the site as well. But worker safety issues are critical. Construction is a major part of the Boston economy, and we want to make sure every construction worker is safe when they're in this city.
So, Frank, I want to invite us to have a moment of solidarity here. When we see tragedies like the three deaths in these last 2 weeks, how does that affect other workers in construction around the state?
Well, as I want to echo Councilor Flynn's comments, our prayers and thoughts go out to all the families, both of the two workers in Boston and the other two workers in Cambridge just later this week. It does affect workers. Construction is one of the most dangerous industries in the country on a good day. And certainly in the circumstances we saw this week, they were very bad for those four workers because, unfortunately, those four workers were not union workers. I mean, not that it matters. They're still workers, and our thoughts and prayers go out to them and their families. But we provide the best safety training, and we monitor that safety training and police our contractors to make sure that our workers are safe. But as I said, even under the best of conditions, construction is a dangerous business.
So, Councilor Flynn, I want to talk about the specifics of Atlantic Coast Utilities, the company involved in last Wednesday's fatalities in Boston. They had a history of OSHA, that's occupational safety and health violations. Now, reportedly, the owner, Lawrence M. Maloney, didn't disclose those violations on affidavits he had to submit to the city. And then it also doesn't appear that the city double-checked the truth of the affidavits that he submitted. So it sounds like there are multiple levels of problem here, both the proprietor not submitting truthful information, but also a failure to confirm at the city level. Is that right?
Well, in the High Street incident that you referenced, that is being investigated. Atlantic Coast Utilities did they fail to disclose to the city that the company had numerous past workplace safety violations, which should have qualified them from construction work. I know the city passed an ordinance that would give the city of Boston the authority to deny or revoke work based on past safety violations or concerns. And also it would require the permit applicant to include a list of all OSHA violations on a signed affidavit with the permit application. So those are critical issues that we have to review, that we have to investigate, we have to get answers to, and also to do everything we can to make sure our work sites are as safe as possible for every worker. And as Frank mentioned, you know, the construction is a very dangerous job, and the construction workers are real heroes in my mind for the work they've done in this city, helping build this city. And we want to make sure we protect all of our construction workers and make sure that they have a living wage, safe working conditions. And at the end of the day, they go back home to their loved ones.
I'd like to go to the phones here because we have a caller in Worcester with an interesting point, 800-423-8255, to join this conversation. Michael's on the line from Worcester. Michael, what's on your mind?
I work in a trade, and sometimes we have to get within 6 feet of each other. We have to wear these masks to stop the spread of COVID. Unfortunately, everything is a trade-off. We want to stop the spread of COVID. The mask is also stopping the spread of my voice. I tell someone else, hey, watch out, don't trip on that. I can't help it. He can't hear me. I'm muffling. My voice is muffled by the mask. His voice is muffled. We got to work together. One, two, three, pick up the object. Very heavy. He can't hear me. I can't hear him. It's much, much harder to work together when we're focusing on one thing. You know, when you do science, if you were to change every variable in the experiment, then you have no idea what's going to happen.
So, Michael, I'm going to take it back from you there. I'm sorry. The irony is you're talking about how hard it is to be heard right now at the workplace. The challenge is we were losing your sound and we were finding you hard to hear from the call. I do apologize about that. Frank Callahan, let me turn back to you. Michael is raising a really practical concern around staying safe during COVID and how that affects other workplace safety practices. You know, we've talked about similar things before, but maybe respond to Michael's call.
Yeah, we share his concerns. We've called for the shutdown of the construction industry last spring because we wanted to flatten the curve like the rest of the population and the economy until we could get a handle on this. And in the interim, we worked very closely hand in hand with our contractor associations to make sure that our members were as safe as possible, like we do on a regular basis. Unfortunately, he's correct. That does exacerbate situations, not just for COVID-19, of course, but for the example he just used, it does make it more difficult. But as we always tell our members, you know, you do what you're told. I don't say you do what you're told, but you do your job, but you never do anything that's unsafe. So I would encourage him, your caller, that if he is asked to be doing something unsafe or it's an unsafe situation, hopefully he's in a union and he's able to speak up that not just on the radio, but to his employer that, I'm not going to do that. You know, you're putting me in danger, and we have to address that situation like we would any other hazardous situation, whether it be hazardous materials, fall concerns, working in heights, or whatever the situation may be. So that has been an issue. It's made it difficult for people working. And as was pointed out, our members can't work from home. You know, in the construction industry, you have to go to the job site, regardless of COVID-19. So we're doing all we can to make sure, as always, that our members are as safe as possible.
Listeners, we are speaking with Massachusetts Building and Trades Council President Frank Callahan and Boston City Councilor Ed Flynn about work site and workplace safety after three deaths in just a week in Greater Boston on job sites. Are you like Michael from Worcester who just called? Do you work in construction? Do you feel safe? Are you challenged by your workplace conditions? We welcome your stories as well. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Councilor Flynn, you know, Frank has said a couple of times, if the worker is in the union, here's what the union can do for them. There's another group of workers we've been hearing a lot about in the news over the last few years, really vulnerable workers, immigrant workers, often undocumented workers who may not be represented by a union or another organization, but who are often finding themselves in work sites that are dangerous, where safety protocols are not being followed. Is it your sense that we have an endemic problem around lack of enforcement or following of the safety protocols on the books? And is that what you're trying to get at with the hearing that's now been approved? I know that the Committee on Small Business and Workforce Development, which is chaired by Councillor Julia Mejia, is taking that over.
Yes, the role of the city or state is critical in protecting the construction workers. We want to, you know, the laws that are currently on the books, we want to make sure that they are enforced. And you're right, the workers that lost their lives were non-union, it was a non-union company, but we want to provide every worker with those same basic rights, really, is the right to go to a workplace that is safe and where safety protocols are respected and you get a decent wage and your wages aren't stolen from you or cut down by a company or trying to cut costs. So we do see a lot of that in this city. Wage theft also is a big issue. I've worked with the Greater Boston Labor Council on this issue, and undocumented workers are taken advantage at times, and it's discouraging. It's really a violation of civil rights, in my opinion, and it's something that won't be tolerated. I know Attorney General Maura Healey has a team that does a lot of wage theft issues, but we have to make sure that the sites are safe for all workers, and including undocumented workers. They deserve respect and dignity also.
Let me shift gears a little bit here. You just referenced Maura Healey. There's another law enforcement professional looking at this. DA Rachel Rollins is looking at the High Street incident last week. Here she is speaking shortly after the incident.
Right now, we don't know if this is a crime. We know that it's a tragedy. And my office is here making sure these families know that we take this very seriously.
So Frank Callahan, as DA Rollins just said, it's being investigated. She said she doesn't know at this point if it's a crime. But should we be looking at these incidents when they happen as crimes more often than we are? Are you satisfied as part of the Massachusetts Building and Trades Council that the Commonwealth looks at the criminal dimension if and when there is one?
No, I'm not satisfied. It is a crime. And the crime that was committed here, in addition to the two workers who lost their lives, was that in order to do this work, to get around the ordinance that the city of Boston passed in 2016, they lied. That's fraud. They lied on their form and they did not disclose that they had at least 5 OSHA violations and 4 serious and 1 willful in order to get that work. If they had disclosed it, they would not have gotten that work. We see this time and time again. I had a firsthand example of this late last year. I sit on a building committee in my town. We're building a high school project, and we had a contractor who not only failed to disclose, but checked the box that no, they had not had fatalities over the look-back period that's required under the law. And just by happenstance, I was having a conversation with someone, and this was after we pre-qualified them, after they bid, and after they were the low bidder, and they said, that contractor had a worker killed on their job within the last year and a half. We went back and looked at that before the contract was awarded. And not only did they lie on the pre-qual process, they lied on their bid forms. And then when we contacted them, they told the town officials that, oh, that worker died of a heart attack. Well, by that time, I had a copy of the OSHA report in my hand, and I was able to inform the rest of the building committee that worker did die of a heart attack, but only after being blasted with scalding hot water and inhaling steam that was full of glycol. I mean, that's not to be flip here, but that's like a murder suspect saying, well, the victim died of lead poisoning, and not saying that I shot them. It's a crime.
Let me take it back from you there, Frank. And just for our listeners' sake, you referred to an incident in 2016. And I want our listeners to know that the result of that in part was the Maddox-Higgins Affidavit of Workplace Safety, which required companies to file at least once a year whether or not they had OSHA citations and violations. That was the affidavit that I referred to with Councillor Flynn earlier, in this particular most recent situation with Atlantic. And so, Councillor Flynn, I want to come back to you with Atlantic Coast Utilities. Excuse me. I want to come back to you. Do we have a teeth and an enforcement problem? And how do we get to the bottom of that?
I think that's a great question. I think we do have laws on the books that would address this issue. They have to be strengthened, but any law in the books, we must enforce it. We're going to go back and look to see whether this company did not provide the relevant information and why didn't appropriate authorities do a review or research this company to see exactly what their history has been in the past. So I think we need to have a one-shop area that can gather this information, track this information, and print it out at one time and know exactly what the company's safety history has been. That all that information should be considered when doing city work or working on a project in the city of Boston. And that will protect the workers and that will protect the residents. But there should be zero excuses for a company such as Atlantic getting any type of project in the city of Boston.
We've got a lot of calls come in. Let's grab a couple here. We've got Susan on the line from Mattapan. Susan, go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. I just wanted to call in and say that this problem starts and ends with our mayor. And he has championed the build and taken away so many standards and precautions. And it's allowed so much of this non-union work to go forward. He's allowed things like the podium build to go forward, which is so dangerous to our city. And as much as I appreciate Councillor Flynn calling for a hearing, which seems to be the spotlight of our city council, three people are dead and one may not survive. So if we want to look where this begins and ends, it's with our mayor, who has allowed all of these safety precautions to go away, which is laughable considering that he goes forward as our labor secretary. I live next to construction.
I'm going to take it back from you there, Susan. Thanks, so that I can give Councillor Flynn a chance to respond. And Councillor Flynn, it does raise the question. You know, Mayor Marty Walsh is waiting to be confirmed by the U.S. Senate as Labor Secretary. OSHA is under the Department of Labor. You hear some strong criticism from Susan there, and also asking the City Council to do more. Let me give you a chance to respond.
I think the City Council should do more. I should do more. I had a hearing last year on this issue, on worker safety issue, and there's more work that I can do, and there will be more work that I will do going forward. And any company that is in my district or in the city, I'm going to work closely with city agencies, city departments, but stress to them that, you know, we take worker safety issues very seriously, and that no company should be on city property if they have a lousy record on worker protection issues. There should be zero tolerance for any of that. And as we, in just to reference Mayor Walsh, he has been a strong advocate of worker protection laws in the city and the state. And I know he'll continue doing that throughout the country, but we still have to recognize that we have issues right here throughout Boston and greater Boston and the state, that we need to take every violation seriously, because at the end of the day, there was two people that didn't go home to their loved ones on High Street and one also in Cambridge. So worker protection are critical, and it's something I take very seriously and I take personally.
I'd like to grab one more quick call here. We've got Trevor on the line in Brighton. Trevor, go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I'm a union laborer. I work for a demolition company. Before I was in the union, I did the same work, and it was much more dangerous. I was just wondering what we thought about utility companies working in the street. Maybe if we moved more to have more union utility companies, there'd be less accidents. Because I know that's very dangerous, a lot like demolition. Thanks.
Thanks for that, Trevor. So, Frank, this feels sort of pointed in your direction. So let me let you pick it up from there.
Sure. I couldn't agree more. We actually have a piece of legislation at the State House this year dealing with pipeline repair, primarily gas pipeline repair, to ensure that there are safety standards for workers, not just in Boston, but all across the state. Because right now, each of the various utility companies has their own safety protocol. And we hear anecdotally that some people that may have a certificate may not have taken the class. So we know what we do. We provide world-class training to our members. We spend over $60 million a year in apprenticeship and skills training for our members all across the state to make sure that, as Councilor Flynn said, they go to work, they earn a good wage, they earn good benefits, but more importantly, they come home safely at the end of the day to their loved ones. That's our top priority, bar none.
So, Frank, just in our last few seconds here, I do want to ask you one follow-up question. Every worker, of course, should feel safe doing their job. But if they don't, what can they do?
Well, you can't call both Occupational Safety and Health Administration, which we're really hoping to see step up when Mayor Walsh is sworn in as Labor Secretary. They've really been restricted on their ability. There's a lot of great inspectors out there, but they've been restricted on their ability to do their job over the last 4 years under the previous administration. In addition, you can call the state, call the Attorney General's office, and say that you're being asked to do unsafe work. Now, without a union contract, I hate to say this, but sometimes you're risking losing your job. No one should be asked to do an unsafe task, whether it's on a construction site or any other workplace setting. But you really are not, they're not allowed to assign you to an unsafe assignment on any job site in Massachusetts or in the country for that matter. So I'd urge workers to call OSHA. You can do it anonymously, and then they would send someone out to inspect the site. But
all right.
I feel for those workers that really don't have that right, unfortunately.
Well, at that, I want to thank you, Massachusetts Building and Trades Council President Frank Callahan and Boston City Councilor Ed Flynn. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Now, whether you're a seasoned bird watcher, or you just like a stroll through the trees, the Mass Audubon Society offers the solace of nature to visitors throughout the Commonwealth. But the Boston-based organization finds itself reckoning with its namesake's ties to slavery as the nation continues its discussions about racial injustice. So WBUR's Kyrie Thompson visited Mass Audubon's Boston Nature Center and has more on the society's struggle with its legacy and its goals to make nature more accessible.
Three toed prints of wild turkeys dot the snowy paths of the Boston Nature Center in Mattapan like dinosaur tracks, and the leafless trees are alive with chirping and the flutter of wings. The Mass Audubon Society's Julie Brandlin, David O'Neill, and Pat Spence peer into the branches for a closer look.
I feel like I see bits of orange on
there. Yeah, I think that's an American robin.
The Mattapan location has been around since the late 1990s, but Mass Audubon itself is more than 100 years old. The society gets its name from renowned conservationist and naturalist John James Audubon, who was famous for his vivid paintings of American birds. But O'Neill, Mass Audubon's president, says the society is now grappling with another piece of its namesake's legacy.
He was a slaveholder, and that's clear. He's also a racist.
O'Neill says the protests against racial injustice following George Floyd's killing last year led the society to reevaluate and retell Audubon's history. An essay on the organization's website now details how Audubon's family bought and sold enslaved people in the early 1800s, and how Audubon himself spoke out against emancipation and abolitionist movements. O'Neill says the society also got a wake-up call from the confrontation between Christian Cooper, a black bird watcher, and a white woman in New York's Central Park the same weekend Floyd was killed.
Please call the cops. I'm going to tell them there's an African-American man threatening my life.
Please tell them whatever you like.
You know, this notion that everyone is welcomed to nature is one that's not necessarily true.
That's Mass Audubon President O'Neill again.
We've been focusing a lot of our time and attention on how do you create equitable access to nature.
Working with O'Neill on that mission is Pat Spence, one of Mass Audubon's four Black board members.
My passion with all this is how do I get more people to a Boston Nature Center that literally live around here? Yeah. It can't just be an ad in a newspaper. It's got to be even more outreach, where oftentimes it's just a one-on-one.
Spence has been coming to these grounds since she was 10 years old and still lives just down the road from the Nature Center in Mattapan, a heavily Black and immigrant neighborhood.
The key is they don't know about it, and there's still people we know, and it could be a stone's throw, that still don't know we're here.
Spence partners with Julie Brandlin, Mass Audubon's Boston Region Director, to bring community groups to Mass Audubon's sanctuaries to encourage them to join. Brandlin says once people know about Mass Audubon's properties, they often return.
It's a fallacy to think that people of color do not come to nature centers. Nature is available to all of us, right?
Mass Audubon says it's not tracking its members' demographic data at this time. But Brandlin says the society is prioritizing diversity in its staff and education programs, including enrollment in Boston Nature Center's preschool and internships like its Youth Leaders Program. David O'Neill also says the society will work with tribal communities to tell the stories of indigenous groups that once lived on its land. He sees Mass Audubon striving more for the spirit of its founding mothers, Harriet Hemingway and Minna Hall, who were both abolitionists in the 1800s, than the man they named their organization after. But O'Neill says Audubon's history should no longer be overlooked, especially in this moment.
Because we carry the name Audubon, we feel responsible for understanding, telling, sharing all of that history, not running from it, but learning from it.
He hopes addressing that past can help create a better, more inclusive present, both in society and in nature.
That was WBUR's Kyrie Thompson. Let's end the day together by getting to know the new Speaker of the Massachusetts House, Representative Ron Mariano. Speaker Mariano, I know we have been trying for a few weeks to make a match with your schedule. I'm so glad you could join us.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome. Great to have you. So let's jump right in. So there are lots of issues facing the state. Kind of feels like an understatement to say that. Obviously, we have the pandemic and the pandemic recovery, which we will need. We've got disparities in education services and results, climate change. There's a lot. So maybe start by telling us, how are you prioritizing? What's at the top of your list for the state legislature?
Well, obviously, the very first thing that we have to deal with is COVID and the resuscitation of our economy and our school system, and you know, getting things back to the whatever the new normal is going to be. Obviously, the issues around the vaccine are of primary importance right now, and it's focusing a lot of our time. You know, the legislature, in recognition of the potential problems that are going to come, have created a COVID committee, both the House and Senate joining together to deal with some of the issues so that we're better prepared for this if it were ever to reoccur, and also to suggest improvements in the way that we've been handling things. So we think it's a good start to resolving some of our issues around the new challenges in public health.
So let's stay with that for a minute. We're just over a week away from the one-year anniversary of the state shutdown. The one-year anniversary of the first case in Massachusetts was at the beginning of February, so we've got some time under our belts now. How I'd like to know, as one of the leaders in the legislature, as the leader in the House, how well would you say the Commonwealth has handled the pandemic today?
Well, I think you have to divide that into two separate categories. I think at the beginning, when we were faced with the pandemic, the closures and some of the decisions that the governor made were right on. But when you now proceed to the vaccine, a vaccine with some limited availability. I think we've had a number of missteps and a number of things that probably could have been done differently.
What is there one thing in particular you could pull out? You said there are a number of things we could have done differently. What's one thing you think we should have done
differently? Well, I think more open communication on the amount of vaccines and how best to access those vaccines. I think the communications from DPH has been poor. I applaud the governor's press conferences, but there needs to be follow-up information, getting into the hands of our constituents.
Is there anything you feel the legislature should have done differently over this last year? You referred to the COVID-19 committees. For a long time, the legislature was pretty hands-off,
We were hands-off because the governor used executive powers at the beginning. And that pretty much takes us out of the equation at the very beginning. And now as we open up and begin to discuss how we're going to handle the vaccine, there's more of a role for us in getting access to the things that are going to get us out of this.
How would you characterize that role? So for someone who's listening who says, okay, so the role the legislature is going to play in getting us out of this specifically.
Well, we do have an oversight role, and we are doing that. We had our first hearing on oversight, and we want to be a productive partner with the governor in getting this done. We only win when this is behind us and we move into the new normal. So we want to be productive. We want to deal with the administration. But we also have a role to make sure that things are done effectively.
Any spending bills, allocation bills, anything around PPP, et cetera, that's on your agenda for this year that you
We'll be seeing some of those things. Obviously, PPP is interesting dilemma. We're working with our friends in the Senate now to come up with a solution, and hopefully
that will be
coming very soon.
So let's go back to the vaccine rollout again for a minute, because you're a former teacher and you have been vocal about getting teachers vaccinated. I know you're aware that the governor yesterday took that step and said March 11th, school workers will move to the front of the line.
It was good to see that he's listening. I have been an advocate for getting teachers vaccinated. As a former teacher, if we really do want to have the goal of having elementary students and staff getting in-person learning, we need an effective plan to reopen. You know, the school buildings, and we need to know that the kids are entering into an environment that we can assure parents is safe and risk-free. So it made obvious sense to me that we needed to get teachers and people who are going to be working in our schools vaccinated.
Are you mostly hearing from your constituents support for that? You know, yesterday we did a call-in. We heard some people call with support. Others angry because whenever someone moves to the front of the line, someone else moves further back in the line.
Yeah, but you know, we've received assurances that there will be more vaccines forthcoming. And listen, I don't want to be in the position of saying that a 65-year-old person with comorbidities is more expendable than a 30-year-old teacher. So,
I'm sorry, I'm just chuckling about the phone in the background. They always wind up catching us off guard. Please go ahead.
I know. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Me too. But it is a difficult call. But as more vaccines become available, we need the prioritization has to be cognizant of the variations in demand at local areas, you know. So I think that that would be the move that we would be asking the governor to make, especially around the schools. It would make sense to be working with local communities around their school systems and getting teachers in where they work, at least in one central location in the town, rather than the mass vaccination centers.
Let's move to a couple of other topics before we sort of run out of time on the show. I want to talk about your choices for leadership positions. You've pledged to focus on diversity in leadership positions. Your new team is getting mixed reviews on that front. Of the 10 people, you're getting strong reviews for 4 women, and the next most senior person is a woman. But there's only one person of color on those 10 people and no Black members of that team. So I want to ask you to address that. Do you think your leadership team reflects the full range of perspectives in the Commonwealth? Do you think there's more to do there?
My pledge in my swearing in was to put a team together that reflected the body that I represent here. And I think I've done that. I think the number of women and the diversity is reflective of the House of Representatives.
And over time in your leadership, would you seek to continue to grow the diversity of your leadership team, both in gender identity diversity, racial diversity, et cetera?
Well, of course, you have to deal with what's available in the body, and I think I've done that. We've spread it out and tried to get a representative sampling of who's in the body, and that's all I can do.
So let's talk about the climate change bill for a minute. It's been really interesting. So you passed a bill in the final hours of the last legislative session that Governor Baker sent back, but he sent it back at the very end. So in the new session, you and Senate President Karen Spilka sent the same bill back again in this new session, veto-proof majorities both times. I know the governor has sent this one back with objections as well. So are you planning to modify based on those objections, or is the plan to try to override any vetoes from the governor?
Well, let me just point out one interesting thing about that. When we sent that bill over at the end of the session, he vetoed it pretty quickly, and which was one of the reasons why we decided to just send back the bill all over again.
So, Speaker, I'm just going to let you know we only have a few seconds. So,
I'm sorry.
Just so you know,
well,
that's okay.
I'm sorry. I'll speed it up a little bit. The reason we sent it back was because he had just blanket vetoed it. When we sent it back, now he's taken some time and he's looked at it. Some of the issues he's suggested in vetoing are technical issues, but we will not, and I will not back down on our ambitious emissions reduction targets. Those are going to stay. I may work with the governor and some technical changes on dates that he may want to make, but nothing substantive will change in this bill.
Well, we'll have to end it there. Thank you so much, Massachusetts Speaker of the House Ron Mariano. Thank you.
Thank you.